Few mixtures are as toxic as absolute power and insanity, where nothing stands between a leader's delusional whims and seeing them carried out. All sorts of bizarre outcomes are possible. It's the subject of a new book by Scott Rank called History's 9 Most Insane Rulers. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the US, Scott Rank himself. Scott, good afternoon to you, or good morning to you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Tell me a little bit then about this book itself. Where does the idea come to put together History's 9 Most Insane Rulers?
Well, there's been a huge growth in populist politicians all over the world, and in the United States since 2016, many mental health professionals have argued that Donald Trump might have mental health issues, narcissistic personality disorder, all sorts of things. And I think this discussion will only accelerate in 2020 when the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee, Joe Biden, some say he has early onset dementia. Now, completely leaving aside those two politicians and other contemporary figures, what I wanted to show is if those are your standards for mentally unwell politicians or rulers, then you have no scope of what happened and came before them. A recent president for life in Turkmenistan had an 80-foot-tall golden statue of himself that rotated to face the sun. Emperor Caligula appointed his horse senator. So however eccentric our current politicians and populist leaders might be today, they're not nearly to the level of the truly mentally ill and legally insane, by the legal definition, rulers of the past.
I mean, that's the one of the thing. I mean, if you're talking going all the way back to Caligula, I mean, there's a huge amount of insane rulers out there to pick from. I mean, how do you whittle it down to 9?
Right. It's not easy. Well, I looked at their actions. So I used the legal definition of insanity, a mental illness of such a severe nature that a person cannot distinguish fantasy from reality. Sometimes this had to do with a genetic issue, like Charles VI of France, who believed he was made of glass. King George III, some believe he suffered from the blood disease porphyria. Others thought it was due to arsenic that was prescribed to him by his physicians. But oftentimes what happens is the issue of megalomania, delusions of grandeur, dictators, authoritarians, presidents for life, who have no meaningful opposition because everyone's terrified of being arrested or sent to a torture chamber or executed. So somebody like Kim Jong-il, who claims the first time he golfed, he shot 9 holes in one and hit 36 under par, he'll say that and he'll come to believe it because nobody questions it. So I think megalomania is one of the most common features that I saw.
I mean, that's one of the things, isn't it? I mean, apart from maybe he was the great undiscovered golf prodigy that we never had. the fact that if you surround yourself with sycophants, if you surround yourself with yes men, then nobody dare come up in opposition against you.
Absolutely. The gentleman I mentioned earlier, the president of Turkmenistan, who had the 80-foot-tall golden statue of himself, he led Turkmenistan in the Soviet era, and then in independence in the 90s, he continued. He seems to use some aspects of ruling according to how Joseph Stalin would prescribe it, having a cult of personality, having statues of yourself and town squares and pictures of yourself. But then he took it a step further. His name was Saparmurat Niyazov. He renamed days of the week and months of the year after himself. He had his own brand of vodka. He was barely literate, but he wrote a holy book and claimed, if you read this book 3 times, God will grant you immediate entrance into heaven. And from what I can see of press accounts about him, he seemed to truly believe this. There's this innocent sort of belief in his greatness, because I think he saw himself and his nation as being one in the same. And if someone is unchecked in power for years and decades, I think almost anyone could go down the same path.
The thing is, of course, I mean, if you're looking at some of the leaders of the more ancient world, as we look back at, say, Caligula, or you look at the president of Turkmenistan coming out of, you know, what used to be the Soviet Union and then being ruled by, you know, a strong man figure, and the same with North Korea. I mean, these are places with no, and or the monarchy, you know, Charles VI, you know, there is no tradition of democracy, therefore nobody can oppose them.
And this is a fault of monarchies. I studied the Ottoman Empire, and this is also what got me to write this book, because when people talk about our mentally ill politicians today, I thought I could name 15 sultans who are much worse. And when you need to perpetuate your dynasty, you will put your son or daughter on the throne, hope that there's a regent to mitigate some of the worst disaster. But someone who shouldn't be there is still there to keep your dynasty going. And in the Ottoman Empire's case, I look at Sultan Ibrahim I in this book, who practiced archery on his court attendees, and he favored full-figured women. So he sent out a call for his advisors to find the largest woman in the empire to join his harem. They found someone who weighed about 150 or 200 kilos, which is very large for the 17th century. And at one point, he had much of his harem drowned because he thought they were plotting to overthrow him. So these are the type of people that are placeholders in a dynasty. And one good reason why monarchy, I think, is no longer with us today in the same way.
Yeah. I mean, yes, getting rid of it. I mean, did you, having your harem drowned and taking archery shots at a large woman, not the... not the the actions of a sensible mind, obviously. I mean, could you? I mean, when you look at these insane rules, I mean, there must be a huge amount of cruelty as well in there that you have to look through.
Right. I mean, some of these people, like Ivan the Great, as he's known in Russia, or Ivan the Terrible, as he's known in the West. The best you could say of him was that he was a high functioning sociopath. He was indifferent to the suffering of others, except for those close to him, or a psychopath, someone who's completely indifferent to the suffering of others. And violence is something that he used to grow the Russian Empire as a tool of government, just as equally as tax collection or having a functioning judicial system. And one person in this book, Idi Amin of Uganda, he's in this book. Adolf Hitler is not. And some people have asked, well, why would you not have what's universally considered to be history's greatest monster? And I said, well, I want to get off some of the main players and show that this is more of a universal issue. But also there was a sort of sadism, at least in the case of Idi Amin and a couple of others, that they seem to delight in torture and personally be involved in it. And that type of sadism, I think, puts them into a different league altogether.
And again, if you go back to Amin, I mean, his thing was the fact that he thought that he was, like they all do, the fathers or the mothers or, you know, they, their own person. You talk about somebody writing, you know, the Turkmenistan ruler writing a book about, you know, getting you into heaven if you read it three times. But they come to personify. They are the country. They are, forget about the body politic. They are literally the body of the nation.
Exactly. And that is the governing philosophy in North Korea, for example, a term called Juche, which means that the will of the people is collectively manifested in the ruler. So when Kim Jong-il or his son Kim Jong-un say things like, when Kim Jong-il was born, a new star brightened the sky and changed winter to spring, they would justify that by saying, well, I'm speaking on behalf of the greatness of the North Korean people, who just so happened to have a leader who is also great, who happens to be me, but I manifest their desires. So that's one side of it. But then the other side of it is, if earlier in their year, when they are doing the political purges of enemies and jailing and executing rivals, the idea is that to speak out against me is to speak about against the state. It's like Louis XIV, La Etat c'est moi. I am the state. I personify it. So that's, I think, the scariest part. Many of these people aren't cold, cynical, cunning people who put on a facade, but are behind the scenes rational. They seem to truly believe what they're saying.
Another thing is the fact that it's almost like a progressive disease. The longer they stay in power, the more and more insane they become.
Many of the things that the anecdotes that fill the book, where you can't believe that these are real people, yes, they do not happen at the beginning of their reign. I suppose the best analogy I've come across is, if you see celebrities and they look clueless and shelled off and sheltered, or say things that you wonder, what sort of world do they live in? What if we gave a celebrity a police squad? What if they could jail other people? What if they could silence dissent? What if they could shut down the paparazzi and then eventually the free press altogether? That sheltering the incipient steps and the nascency that we see in celebrities or some politicians. When you completely lack a free press altogether, when you completely lack any sort of criticism, then at least among megalomaniacs, that leads to things like Kim Jong-il using heavily racist language against Western nations and calling them a mongrel race. But he also loves Elvis Presley and styles his hair after the king. That's how you get things like that.
I'm just reeling from that thing. I just remembered that one as well. Is it important as well to, and I'm not condoning these actions, but to set them in context to what's going on in their world at the time? And I mean, you talked about the Ottoman Sultan Ibrahim I practicing archery, but at the same time, I mean, a lot of the Turks in sort of the 11th and the 12th centuries would drink. I mean, the Turks at that time were not the Turkish we understand it. It was the nomads who came off the steeps, but a lot of them were sort of drinking out the skulls of their enemies. So, you know, a couple of archery shots seems quite mild by comparison.
Right. And that is some biographers of Ivan the Great or Terrible, whatever you prefer, will say that, like you mentioned in context, he completely destroyed the city Novgorod. Farms were burned around it in order to trigger a famine. Raping, looting, mass murder went on for days and days. But those who try to set in context will say he was fighting the daughter states of the Mongolian Empire, and frequently raids would come into Moscow and other cities and capture thousands of people and haul them off to slave markets. So he was using very heavy-handed tactics to secure his borders and put down his enemies, because what he did was highly unpleasant, but the alternative was worse. And like you mentioned with Ibrahim, yeah, shooting a few people in a time of extreme violence that is almost impossible for us to comprehend today. Many of us think, well, it simply didn't exist because I couldn't imagine seeing that. Well, it did exist at that time. And those who call Ivan great say, well, maybe he had to rule as a mad ruler in mad times. And that was the most reasonable thing to do.
I'm just trying to work out how, you know, King Charles the Sixth could get away with thinking he was made out of glass and his courtiers saying that, yes, sire, you are.
That some argue that he had a genetic condition, as many royals did at the time. Sometimes it was the blood disease porphyria. Sometimes it was other conditions. He suffered the glass delusion. He thought he was made of glass. He told his advisors to tiptoe toward him so he didn't shatter. They couldn't wear shoes in his presence. This was a condition in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance. Not just Charles, but others as well. Cervantes wrote a short story about this too. The best historians can make of it is that at the time in the late Middle Ages, glass was a fairly new invention, glass windows, and priests and preachers would use the analogy of glass as something to be pure. Those who couldn't well distinguish reality from imagination thought that, well, in order to be holy, they believe themselves to literally be made of glass. So I suppose it's similar to those who watch a movie with aliens and they believe those scenes that they saw are real, and they thought that I was quite literally abducted by aliens. The glass solution doesn't exist anymore, but maybe it's changed into things like alien abductions, if that makes sense.
If we talk about this, you know, the truly crazed leading countries, I suppose in a world where we have access to 24/7 social media, Instagram, and I say through gritted teeth, Twitter. yes, can a truly crazed leader influence his followers via that? Do you think? I mean, I know that he famously once said he could shoot somebody in the middle of Times Square and get away with it, but do you think there is now more of a people looking out for a strong leader are perhaps more likely to forgive these what could be going on because they're seeing it, you know, is spreading so quickly?
Right. I mean, social media is absolutely a double-edged sword, and some of these insane rulers that are products of the monarchical form of government, I don't think we're going to see many people like that anymore, with the exceptions of like the Kim family in North Korea.
Yeah.
But with social media, oddly, it seems to connect rulers to their fan base, their supporters, and bypass channels that would have prevented them in the past. I read in a foreign policy journal that in the 1960s and 1970s, the idea was if you wanted to topple a weak nation in Latin America or Africa, all it really took was taking over the presidential palace, taking over the parliament, and the national media. You do those three things and you can essentially engineer a military coup. Nowadays, it doesn't work that way. When there was attempted military coup against Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in 2016, he used iMessage to talk to people directly and called protesters to step out and push back against the coup. Erdogan, don't like him very much. I think give him enough years in power, he could very well go down that road if he isn't already a fair distance down it. So that's the double-edged sword. You bypass all sorts of institutions and you connect directly with people. And to be a demagogue populist has never been easier.
I'm just trying to think. The thought just occurred to me, you know, imagine if the insane rulers of the past had had access to social media. I should imagine that Caligulas would be done for nudity, and even the great or terribles wouldn't even get past, would it, the Instagram? I mean, that would be quite something. Ivan's Instagram would be quite something to behold.
Yeah, I would be terrified to see Caligula's Twitter feed. I've never thought of that before. So
what do you hope that people will take out of your book, History's Nine Most Insane Rulers?
Well, I think that it's very healthy to criticize our politicians and push back against them. On one hand, I do want to give some context that what we're experiencing isn't new in certain aspects. Politicians have always been narcissistic, self-obsessed, some of them very mentally weak. So things that we're seeing in the 20th century, whether you think it's Donald Trump, whether any nation you care to look at, Brazil, the United Kingdom, nothing about it is new. But I would also say very healthy to push back against politicians, find way to pierce the bubble that they try to create a mount around themselves with sycophants and yes men and others. Because if they lose that, if they don't realize that there are significant pockets of opposition to them and they can push back against their narcissism, if you don't have that, then eventually you have a president for life that renames days of the week and months of the year after himself. So don't presidents for life are bad, is, I suppose, one aspect.
I was going to say, who is your, if you like, I know it's a difficult, it's an oxymoron, but who is your favorite insane ruler that you came across?
Oh, well, I would say absolutely Ludwig II of Bavaria. And I want to be clear here that when we're using words insane, mental illness, and I'm using saying the legal sense of their actions, mental illness, of course, does not make someone a bad person. Some of our greatest wartime leaders in history had mental or they struggle with mental illness, specifically depression, like Martin Luther King Jr., Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln. And biographers would say it was not in spite of, but because of that struggle that gave them the fortitude to face challenges later. Ludwig of Bavaria seemed to live in a dream world. He loved reading fantasy and epics of knighthood and King Arthur epics. He built fairy tale castles all throughout Bavaria, nearly bankrupted Bavaria, which is likely why he was forced out. But today, when we consider Germany, people will think of Neuschwanstein, Herrn Chiemsee, all of the different castles. They'll think of Lederhosen and Dirndls, even though Germans will insist, if they're not from Bavaria, we do not wear that. It's only Bavarians. But the architecture of Bavaria has become coterminous almost with Germany. And it was because of this dreamer, Ludwig, who had conversations at dinner time with imaginary friends like Louis XIV and Marie Antoinette. So he followed his passions. He was not a violent man by any means. And so I think that's why he was my favorite person to look at.
And he left a legacy of chocolate box type medieval fortresses and castles which, for no military use throughout Bavaria. Just one question. I have to ask you this. Who was number 10? Who just didn't get the cutoff point?
Yeah, that is a good choice because there's so many people to choose from. How do you possibly cut it down? I think the Enver Hoxha in the 20th century in Albania, where if you go to Albania today, I'm sure your listeners know this, there are thousands and thousands of these little concrete bunkers where people can go into. It's a fallout shelter, but I don't know how well they would have worked. It looks very tacky today. He competes with this president from Turkmenistan for a cult of personality. But I think it's, one of the challenges with the book is what's the distinction between barbarism of brutality which is almost the standard across history for kings or presidents or emperors or whomever else, between brutality and insanity. And so many were following on the side of the ledger of brutality that that's part of why he didn't make the book.
The book is called History's Nine Most Insane Rulers. It's by Scott Rank. Scott, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, where can they find you? Where, if you have an internet presence, where can they find you?
The best place is if you go to historyunpluggedpodcast.com. That's where I have my podcast on history, and then all of my other means of contacting me are listed there as well.
Only begs the question, what are you up to next?
I'm doing a massive series on World War One right now with a co-host. We've done a series in the past called Presidential Fight Club, where all 44 American presidents fight each other one-on-one.
Right.
I don't mean fight in the argumentative sense, but fisticuffs in a tournament style. So might expand that out. Thought about a book project. So that's something to think about.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. This book is called History's Nine Most Insane Rulers. It's by Scott Rank. It's a brilliant read. Scott, thank you so much for your time today.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.